We are around this country fighting against this domestic terrorism. We're not going to stop at just arresting the violent criminals we can see in the streets. Just like we did with cartels, we're going to take the same approach, President Trump, with Antifa. Destroy the entire organization from top to bottom.
Just as soon as we can figure out where they hold their meetings.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
It ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN, up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Richmond, Virginia's WRWK, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and, of course, Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internet. It's on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, Delmarva FM, and most of your favorite podcast sites blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, an all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us for another thrilling edition of The Bradcast. All right, joining us shortly, investigative journalist Josh Kavinsky of Talking Points Memo will be here to discuss not one, but two new stories that he has up at TPM this week. Both kind of insane, both kind of troubling, though in completely different ways. One. Hi, Desi Doyen.
Hi. Insane and troubling is kind of the theme for this year, I guess.
Exactly. This year.
Well, yeah. The Trump era.
Decade, yeah. One of those stories on Donald Trump drumming up once again one of the wackiest of the 2020 sore loser conspiracy theories that he has about how that year's election was stolen from him. A wacky theory, but made more troubling, I suppose, thanks to the FBI's raid of the Fulton County, Georgia elections warehouse last week outside of Atlanta. And the other, a really disturbing story in truth about how the administration, sort of heard Pam Bondi there at the top of the show referencing this, how the administration has taken one of the legal tools enacted following 9/11 to target actual terrorist organizations, and is now applying that those statutes to its ideological opponents, like Black Lives Matter, or anyone belonging to the imaginary Antifa organization, or even those who simply espouse, according to an administration memo, quote, anti-Americanism, anti-capitalism, and anti-Christianity. You know, just as many of us had warned many, many years ago was likely to happen when Congress rushed to pass things like the Patriot Act in the wake of the 2001 terror attacks, and folks, including myself, and yes, my family, were actually found to have been targeted politically by tools that were developed for the so-called war on terror. We will get to all of that momentarily, but a couple of news items of note before Josh joins us today. Just a quick heads up out there. You've probably heard the headline today that the Trump administration is withdrawing 700 border agents from Minnesota. That Donald Trump thinks we need a softer touch. up there? Yeah, well, assuming any of that is true, don't get too excited, as that would, at best, only bring down the number of ICE and CPB thugs in the Twin Cities area to more than what is supposedly were there when Renee Good was shot dead in the streets by ICE back in January. After which the White House doubled down at the time. They surged an additional 1,000 militarized goons into the region, where they will still now, even with this drawdown, far outnumber local police, even if they actually do it. As the Minnesota Star Tribune reported this morning, White House border czar Tom Homan said Wednesday that effective immediately, the federal government is withdrawing 700 federal law enforcement personnel from Minnesota. That will leave the number of agents in the state at about 2,000, he said, still a far cry from the 150 agents who are normally permanently stationed in Minnesota to carry out immigration enforcement.
So that's really only about a 20-something withdrawal, 20% withdrawal.
If that. I can't do math on the fly, but it's still 2,000 of these thugs there. Homan claimed that his goal is to reduce the footprint back to that number, to 150. That's his goal, but he said it would only happen once residents of Minnesota stop, quote, impeding Immigration and Customs Enforcement and Customs and Border Protection agents from doing their job. He said, quote, protest, but stop impeding because we will arrest you. So, yeah, sounds to me at least like little is actually changing on the streets of Minneapolis today, though the administration has figured out how to get a headline that sounds good to those who are not paying particularly close attention. Late today, Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey seemed to confirm that much on CNN when he was asked about Trump's comments today that a, quote, softer touch was needed in Minneapolis. Sure, a softer touch. Less murdering of people on the streets, perhaps.
President Trump said in an interview that a softer touch is required. What do you say to President Trump?
He's right that a softer touch has been required. The drawdown of both federal agents as well as the implementation of body cameras is obviously a step in the right direction. That being said, the continued presence of 2,000 federal agents in a city that only has 600 police officers is still not de-escalation. So we have been very clear that Operation Metro Surge needs to end. The restoration of peace, of safety, the rejuvenation of small local businesses throughout our city depends on one main thing, which is for ICE to leave. And so that continues to be our position.
So in the meantime, the real story of, federal staffing issues at this point, federal staffing levels in Minnesota, the real story is actually in the courts today, where even though the Trump administration is able to surge thousands of overpaid and undertrained militarized thugs pretty much overnight to the streets of Minneapolis to terrorize residents, they aren't able to find enough lawyers to support their out-of-control roundups of non-citizens and citizens alike in and around the Twin Cities area, apparently. Last week, the chief federal judge of the Minnesota Circuit, in the case of a detainee who was supposed to have been released from detention like 2 weeks earlier, he issued an order demanding that the acting director of ICE, a guy by the name of Todd Lyons, show up in person in court to explain to the judge why the Trump administration, which has been failing to release detainees despite court orders to do so, had violated some 96 court orders in 78 different cases since just the beginning of this year. If the man in this particular case had been released by last Friday, the judge said that Lyons would not have to show up. And what do you know? The man was, in fact, released before Todd Lyons had to come to Minneapolis and testify. But this week, we are now beginning to get a clearer picture of how things are really falling apart for the federal government, at least in court in Minnesota. Last week, it was reported that six top prosecutors in the U.S. Attorney's Office had just quit following the refusal of the DOJ to investigate the Renee Good killing and then the Alex Preddy murder by immigration officials. On Monday, I believe it was, we learned that eight more top prosecutors from the office in Minnesota had quit. So that's like 14 of the top prosecutors in the office. And then late on Tuesday, as first reported by Fox 9 in Minneapolis, I believe, a federal judge in Minnesota, a different one, demanded to know from an official at the U.S. Attorney's Office during a court hearing why ICE is not complying with court orders and failing to immediately release immigrants who are being wrongfully detained as part of Operation Metro Surge. Now, as you may have heard, because it's an incredible story, as you may have heard late last night in federal court on Tuesday, apparently the stress of working for the U.S. Attorney's Office in Minnesota apparently got to one of its lawyers who was volunteering there to help the short-staffed office. Attorney Julie Lee was representing the government at the hearing over ICE's failure to follow court orders. And when Judge Jerry Blackwell asked why the agency is not complying, Lee said that the government was, quote, overwhelmed, unquote, by the legal challenges to Operation Metro Surge, and that trying to get ICE to comply with court orders has required nonstop work for an office depleted by resignations. She said, quote, I wish you would just hold me in contempt of court so I can get 24 hours of sleep, Lee said, adding, quote, the system sucks, this job sucks, and I'm trying with every breath I have to get you what you need. She said this in court.
I know. I feel bad for anybody in that situation.
Yeah, no, I do too.
Just on a human level.
Now, as it turns out, apparently Lee does not normally work for the U.S. Attorney's Office. She used to work as an attorney for ICE in immigration court. And last month, she volunteered to help the prosecutors at the U.S. Attorney's Office to deal with the many habeas petitions from immigrants in ICE detention who are seeking their release. Fox 9 reports that there have been more habeas petitions from immigrants in the first part of the year than in all of 2025. Lee has apparently been assigned more than 85 cases since the beginning of January. And she admitted to Judge Blackwell that ICE is just out of its depth and was not prepared to argue cases in federal courts. She said, quote, we have no guidance or direction on what we need to do, which is just amazing. Now, remember, a lot of these folks are career officials. They're career prosecutors, career lawyers in ICE, at the U.S. Attorney's Office. These are not necessarily Trumpers. They're just trying to, you know, do their best, hold on to their jobs, and do what is required of them.
And who could have predicted that a sudden mass deportation surge would overwhelm the system? Oh, yeah, that's right. Everybody did.
Yeah. And, of course, if you didn't know it before, you certainly knew it when you started hearing those reports about first six of the top attorneys leaving the office, then another eight leaving the office. Well,
yeah, it's really bad management.
Julie Lee.
On top of everything else.
And I agree. I feel bad for her as well. And today, shortly before airtime, this, again, from Fox News, they report two attorneys will no longer be working for the U.S. Attorney's Office for Minnesota after acknowledging in court this week that the federal government is, quote, overwhelmed by litigation coming out of Operation Metro Surge. Fox 9 confirmed that Julie Lee will no longer be handling immigration-related cases for the USA's office in Minnesota. So she is out. Not clear, at least from this report, where she will go, if she's out entirely, if she's been fired entirely. But she will no longer be trying to keep up with, 85 cases over the past month for the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Maybe now she'll get some rest.
Lee, who Fox 9 notes had appeared emotional at times during Tuesday's court hearing, when she said, "This job sucks. Please find me in contempt so I can get some sleep." Well, she was apparently comforted in court at the time by her colleague, Anna Voss. Voss is the chief civil attorney responsible for managing more than 600 habeas petitions that have been filed since ICE ramped up enforcement operations in Minnesota. But the Fox 9 investigators confirmed that, yes, Voss is also now leaving the already depleted department. So, and again, don't know where she's going, if she was pushed out, if she quit. But that's what's going on right now for the attorney side of things. They have no problem with, you know, hundreds and thousands of thugs on the streets to round these people up. But when it comes to, you know, actually giving them due process in court, well, we don't have time to staff those people up. And speaking of federal staffing issues in the Trump administration, where not only more than a dozen top prosecutors quit in recent weeks at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Minnesota, but the six top prosecutors in the civil rights section at Main Justice in D.C. also quit following the murder of Renee Good after they were ordered to shut down their investigation of her shooting by an ICE thug in Minneapolis. Well, other career federal law enforcement officials are also saying enough is enough, or being pushed out because they simply won't follow this madness. As we suggested last week when the story was breaking out of Atlanta, and as we now know, thanks to reporting by MS Now, the special agent in charge of the FBI's Atlanta field office was forced out just a week or so before the Fulton County raid last week, after questioning the DOJ's renewed push to probe Fulton County's role in the 2020 election, which culminated last week with the FBI seizing voting records at the Fulton County Elections Hub warehouse. Paul Brown at the FBI was ousted after expressing concerns about the FBI's investigation into Donald Trump's longstanding and unsubstantiated allegations of voter fraud in the county anchored by Atlanta, and for refusing to carry out the searches and seizures of the records tied to the 2020 election, according to sources who spoke to MS Now. Brown was appointed to oversee all investigations and personnel in Georgia just last February. The Associated Press reported that the FBI moved to replace him just over a week or so ago. Fulton County Chair Rob Pitts called the investigation a distraction and an intimidation tactic by the Trump administration, telling reporters last week, quote, "Any honest review of these files will show what every previous review has shown. Fulton County elections are fair and lawful, and the outcome of the 2020 election will not change." Well, we will see about that. Especially since, at this point, the FBI has absconded with the ballots, about 700 boxes of them. And they have thus, in the bargain, broken the chain of custody for those ballots. So who knows what they will end up claiming about them? Oh, we recounted them and we found out Donald Trump actually won in Atlanta. Okay, sure. curiously, as several folks have noticed, however, the Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, she was also on site that day last week when the FBI raided Fulton County during that raid of the county's election warehouse. The Director of National Intelligence usually has nothing whatsoever to do with domestic law enforcement issues. So what was Tulsi Gabbard doing there in Atlanta? And not just at Atlanta, she was actually at the raid. So we still don't know, but maybe Donald Trump gave us a hint or two, maybe, in the days that followed the raid last week when he issued a A series of posts at his failing social media site that referenced one of the, let's say, kookier of the many evidence-free claims made after the 2020 election by Trump and his supporters about the super-secret, apparently evidence-free ways that Joe Biden stole the election from him. You remember there was the Chinese or was it the Vietnamese ballots that were airdropped into Phoenix somehow? Remember that?
Yes.
That you could tell because of the bamboo in their paper that they were never able to find. Then there was the whole Chinese, was it the smart thermostats that were secretly somehow used, I don't know if it was by the Chinese or someone else, to hack the tabulators through those. And these are actual, I know they're kind of funny, but these are actual theories that were forwarded over and over again after the 2020 election. And, of course, as Trump was once again posting about after the FBI raid in Atlanta last week, the Italian military satellites that somehow Barack Obama, with the help of the Chinese, it seems, and money from Iran, were able to commandeer in order to hack the vote tabulators from the satellites in space on behalf of Joe Biden. That may be, of course, the craziest sounding one of them all, but Donald Trump was tweeting about it last week over and over again. We will pick up that story and another that, frankly, is far more disturbing regarding the Trump administration's reinterpretation of a post-9/11 terrorism statute to go after his political opponents. Both of those stories are straight ahead with Josh Kavinsky on the broadcast. Buckle up. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial.
Hey, this is Desi. The broadcast and the Green News Report survive thanks to you and your support. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate today to help us stay independent every day over your public airwaves. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Spies came out of the water. But you're feeling so bad, 'cause you know. But the spies hide out in every corner.
Every corner.
But you can't touch them, no.
Welcome back to the broadcast, Brad Friedman. From bradblog.com. The spies are everywhere. Talking Points Memos. Josh Kavinsky over the last few days has published two reports, each disturbing on their own, if I think in very different ways. Each is also both stunning and, at least to some of us, not all that surprising, also in their own way. One is mostly just insane, even if it's troubling, as it involves yet another absurd chapter in sore loser Donald Trump's years-long effort to convince people that he really didn't lose to Joe Biden in 2020, as he revised one of the kookier theories for his loss that you may or may not have heard over the years. We covered it way back when it first emerged, at least a little, and it regards, as Kavinsky describes it, quote, an elaborate conspiracy in which Barack Obama and China teamed up to use Italian military satellites to zap the election away from Donald Trump. Sure, that probably happened, right? Never mind the lack of any actual, you know, tangible evidence to support the scheme. But with approval polls plummeting for himself and his party, Epstein files implicating Trump in various ways, if still unproven, and his violent immigration campaigns terrifying and enraging a nation, why not return to the glory days of yesteryear's election denialism? Sure, that should help keep the midterms from becoming an embarrassment for both Trump and his Republican Party. And in a far darker turn of events, one that many of us years ago now tried to warn about, Kavinsky also reports in an exclusive deep dive this week on how Trump's Department of Justice has turned a post-9/11 statute, originally meant to be used in terrorism cases, against Americans that, as Kavinsky writes, President Trump has cast as his political enemies. The new policy, Kavinsky reports, represents a dramatic departure from how the Justice Department has historically used the federal so-called Material Support for Terrorism statute, known as 2339A, originally meant to be used after 9/11, as he describes, for the kinds of audacious terrorism plots that wreak real, lasting damage or whose ambition forms the stuff of movie screenplays. But after the Trump DOJ leadership issued a series of memos demanding that prosecutors employ the provision to help target those who espouse, quote, anti-Americanism, anti-capitalism, and anti-Christianity, both the focus and the standards in these cases have changed, he writes. The memos direct federal law enforcement to use speech, including, quote, extremism on migration, race, and gender, whatever that may mean, as key criteria for who to investigate and against whom to bring the most aggressive charges possible under this statute. They are part of the Trump administration's broader crusade against the left and include executive orders, for example, labeling Antifa a terrorist organization and directing law enforcement to pursue investigations and possible charges against left-leaning advocacy groups and their funders, and yes, their associates, all with the help of a tool supposedly created to defend against foreign terrorism now deployed against Americans, including those who have nothing to do with terrorism at all. Folks, for example, who are simply protesters exercising free speech rights against ICE detention facilities. Joining us now to make sense somehow of both of these stories is Josh Kavinsky, investigative reporter for Talking Points Memo in New York City. Oh, Josh Kavinsky, welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Thanks for having me on, Brad. I appreciate it.
Okay, neither of these stories, frankly, is particularly easy to sum up in an intro. So I'm hoping I have accurately, in summary, sort of set each of them up. But let's begin with the old Italy Gate chestnut, since it's a somewhat lighter lift here, I think, now being revived by the President of the United States some 5 years after it first made its way through the rabbit holes and conspiracy theories of the old Donald Trump 2020 Stop the Steal desperation campaign. Can you explain this theory? Because I've tried for years to make heads or tails of it, even of what is being alleged here. And frankly, given my own decades-long investigative reporting on voting systems and their many vulnerabilities, I am still not sure how this one was alleged to have worked, or was, you know, supposed to have worked, and I'm damn sure Donald Trump doesn't know either. It includes Barack Obama, China, Italy, Switzerland, Iran, Dubai, and somehow the CIA. So I'll let you put all of that in order for us, Josh. Good luck.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's not an easy task, but I think it's important to remember that after the 2020 election, one thing that a lot of conservatives online and conservative conspiracy theorists seized on was what appeared to be what they called dumps of votes. And that meant, 50,000 votes being tallied in, some county, let's say in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And what they would usually mean was just that voting officials were uploading the results. But this became kind of something suspicious to a lot of people on the right, especially people who were looking to cast doubt on Biden's victory that year. And so a couple people came up with this theory called Italygate, which attributed those uploads of tallied votes to elaborate conspiracy involving Italian military satellites. And so basically the idea, and you can kind of, there are many versions of this, just sort of like a whole Italy Gate cinematic universe associated with it.
Right.
But the basic idea here is that Barack Obama, in league with the Chinese government, decided to take a bunch of money from the Iran nuclear deal in cash and siphon it to an Italian defense contractor named Leonardo via the U.S. Embassy in Rome. And so under this theory, Leonardo then used its military satellites to zap a bunch of voting machines and vote tabulators in America, thereby leading to the big votes, the big sort of like vote dumps, and thereby leading to Trump's supposed defeat. So that's the kind of core of it. I think, you know, there's even more detail you can go into about China, and there's a whole sort of like United Arab Emirates subplot that some people talk about, but that's the basics.
And as crazy as this sounds, zapping Italygate, zapping dumps of votes, as they call them, from the satellite to change the results. And frankly, as much as it's easily disproven by, you know, inspection of the actual hand-marked paper ballots that were actually cast by voters in at least most jurisdictions across the country, Trump's then chief of staff, Mark Meadows, and even the acting officials at the Department of Justice at the time, after Bill Barr had left in no small part because of Trump's sore loserism here, they reportedly looked into this allegation. And any idea what they found?
They didn't find anything, you know, surprisingly enough. But I think it's a really instructive lesson how bad things have gotten. Because in 2020, when Mark Meadows was looking into this, he was universally rejected by senior DOJ leadership. But the one person in the government at the time who did go along with it was Kash Patel, who at that point was an appointee deep within the Pentagon. He was the acting chief of staff to then acting Secretary of Defense. And so what Kash Patel asked defense officials to investigate it, two American officials ended up going to a prison in Italy, meeting somebody there who was, I think, on trial for a fraud investigation involving this Italian defense contractor, interviewing him, and sort of nonsense. But the point is that, you know, the one person in government back then who was willing to go forward with it and was kind of ridiculed for it and at the time is now in charge of the FBI.
He's now running the FBI. Does Kash Patel or anyone else, and I guess, you know, no charges were ever brought. No, this, you know, sort of quickly went away at the time because there was just it was so insane. But, you know, nothing's too insane for Kash Patel. But any idea why China and Italy and Iran and all of the and the CIA and Barack Obama, et cetera, any idea why they didn't revive that nefarious but apparently very effective plot to similarly steal the 2024 elections from Donald Trump? Information there?
Brad, you know, your guess is as good as mine. And I mean, it's an interesting question for all of the 2020 election conspiracy theories, is why it was easier for Democrats to steal the 2020 election when they were out of power and harder for them to steal the 2024 election when they were in power. I haven't heard anybody answer that question, but, you know, if you hear anybody, you should let me know.
I will. Let you know right away. And all of this is being revived by the president. I mean, we can joke about it all we want, but the fact is Donald Trump, the president of the United States himself, is reviving this, I guess, in the wake of the FBI's raid, Kash Patel's raid of the Fulton County, Georgia elections warehouse last week, where they reportedly exercised a search warrant to remove hundreds of boxes of ballots and tabulator tapes and other material from the 2020 election that had been, you know, kept securely under seal. And now they have broken the chain of custody for that material. But with one added element that has, as you report, sort of come to delight the 2020 QAnon folks, the still unexplained presence at that raid of Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard, who would normally have nothing to do with local law enforcement. Do you have any idea what she was doing there and if somehow the Italygate satellite conspiracy ties into it?
Well, as you point out, you know, the agencies that she are within her like remit, those within the intelligence community, cannot act within the United States they only can act within the United States under specific circumstances, right? I mean, they're all meant to be externally focused. The job is foreign surveillance, not domestic. So the fact that she was there already is kind of a hint about what might be going on. But the thing that really, I think, alarmed people was that in the hours after she was seen at the raid, President Trump went on Truth Social and reposted a bunch of things, including a link laying out the Italy Gate conspiracy theory. So that led a lot of people to think that that might be part of the investigation, that it might somehow be connected to the raid in Fulton County.
And why Tulsi Gabbard was there, somehow connecting these dots from foreign interference to what happened on the ground in Fulton County. We will keep our eyes. Do keep us apprised, Josh, if you get any new breaks in the in that Italy Gate case. But turning now to something that sounds almost as outlandish, frankly, but it's actually based on demonstrable documented evidence and reality. Back in, and pardon this sidebar for a moment, Josh, but back in 2011, documents from a company named H.B. Gary were hacked and exposed by the hacker group calling itself Anonymous. These documents detailed a $12 million proposal to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce at the time that would use software made by a little-known company at the time named Palantir to target opponents of the very right-wing leadership of the Chamber of Commerce at the time. The plan laid out in the proposal, which I published at bradblog.com at the time, since, as it turns out, the group was proposing at the time targeting me and then progressive blogger Glenn Greenwald back then. But it targeted not just me and Glenn, but it actually targeted our families and associates in great detail and chilling detail with this Palantir software created for the so-called global war on terror, now turned against U.S. citizens like Glenn Greenwald and myself and my family, and anyone that, you know, Palantir characterized somehow as an associate of ours. Tools created after 9/11 for the war on terror turned against Americans. Well, your chilling story this week at TPM headlined Trump DOJ files 9/11 era charges against leftists across the country kind of reminded me of that. It details a not dissimilar story of how the DOJ has now taken post 9/11 terror statutes, if I understand your piece correctly, and turned them, yes, against politically disfavored Americans or anyone that they are associated with by characterizing them as terrorists. Am I essentially understanding that in general correctly?
Yeah, you are. I mean, these are material support for terrorism statutes. It sounds dry, but it's important. What it is a crime. It makes it a crime to do what it sounds like, help terrorists commit acts of terrorism. And they're now being applied to situations where there was an act of criminality allegedly that took place at a protest. But if that took place, if the protest was associated with a left-wing cause or something opposed to the administration, then we're now starting to see the DOJ go after it as terrorism.
They're going after it as terrorism. And you just to help folks understand how this now appears to be working against those that Trump perceives as his really political foes, tell me about this incident from August of last year involving a fire inside of a Walmart outside of Birmingham, Alabama, and how this reinterpretation of this statute 2339A is actually affecting the prosecution in that case.
Yeah, I think that's a great example. I mean, what happened was, as you said, there was a protest in Birmingham, Alabama in August, and the protest had to do with the shooting of a local unarmed black teen. At the protest, the Black Lives Matter protest, one participant allegedly leaves, the government says, goes to a Walmart, and allegedly sets it on fire. That man, Mercutio Southall,
Let me jump in. He sets a fire, right? He didn't set the Walmart on fire, did he? He set a fire in his cart full of things.
Yeah, he fills. So he fills a shopping cart full of items, some toilet paper, kerosene, lights it on fire. I think part of the Walmart does maybe catch a little bit, but it really is redirect. That's correct. It's mostly contained in the shopping cart.
Right.
And so he's initially charged with arson. There is some damage to the Walmart, but he's charged with arson at the state level. Prosecutors come in, federal prosecutors come in a month later, charge him with federal arson. Okay. That's all relatively within the bounds of what we would expect, I think, under any administration. Maybe mm-hmm. it's a little aggressive. But then what's different, what really is changing the game, is that the DOJ comes in a month later, this is now in November, and charges him with material, him and another person who allegedly helps him escape, with material support for terrorism, with the terroristic act allegedly being the fire at the Walmart. So the only, from all the experts I talked to, and that included former, longtime national security prosecutors, counterterrorism prosecutors in the Department of Justice, the only reason they could find for why that might be terrorism would be if you think association with Black Lives Matter gets you there. In his case, it's gonna, if you just give listeners a sense of how much graver this makes a charge like that, mm-hmm. Arson, I think the guideline sentence there is like maybe 10-ish years, but with material support for terrorism, if you're convicted on that, prosecutors can then apply for a terrorism enhancement, which means that if you have no prior criminal history, and regardless of whether or not the underlying charge was nonviolent, it could be something as simple as spray painting a government building, you're now looking at a recommended minimum for the judge of 17 and a half years behind bars. So it dramatically increases the severity of the possible sentence. And the only link that we could find in these cases, because there are a couple others, was the fact for why they're being charged was a supposed link, the protests involving left-wing ideologies.
So 17 and a half years he could be facing in this case where he lit a fire in his shopping cart in the Walmart because we bring in a terrorism enhancement to it. And with that enhancement to it, as a Chicago attorney, you quoted in here, Josh Herman, who has represented defendants in such material support for terrorism cases, he says that bumps everything into a whole different category of prosecution under this new interpretation of 2339A. That means that they can not only prosecute him, they can increase the years that he's facing, but also go after basically his associates as if this was a terror ring, go after other people in Black Lives Matter, other people who participated in that protest, et cetera, correct?
That's right. And there's another really interesting case where I think where that's playing out right now. There was a protest outside a ICE detention facility in July. Where a police officer was shot. They've now charged everybody who was at the protest with material support for terrorism, regardless of whether or not they were anywhere near the shooting or anywhere near the gun or had any real connection to what was going on. But what's interesting there is the government is talking about that investigation as an enterprise case, which suggests exactly what you just described. They're not looking at members of so-called Antifa, whatever that means, mm-hmm. in that case, in the greater Dallas-Fort Worth area, as being part of this kind of unified criminal enterprise. So it gives the government greater powers to investigate, but it also just raises, unbelievably grave concerns around freedom of speech, freedom of association.
Right. Somebody could, as in this case, I could go to a protest outside an ICE facility. I can protest. Somebody commits a crime of some sort. And it doesn't have to be a grave crime, lighting off fireworks or something. And if I'm understanding correctly, I can somehow, I'm not the one who lit off the fireworks, but because I was participating in that protest, somehow they can group me in as a part of a terrorist scheme and hold me accountable for something that I had nothing to do with whatsoever.
Right. And so in this Texas case, there are people who were at the event. But the only thing the prosecutors, as far as I know, are alleging that ties them to the shooter is that they were dressed similarly. They were dressed in black, so they were dressed in black block, and that they were supposedly, allegedly involved in the printing of what the government describes as insurrectionary materials known as zines. So your listeners might be familiar. A zine is like a small, independently printed pamphlet. Mm-hmm. But the government is saying that because there's an insurrectionary ideology in these zines, which really are mostly like, there was one about, kind of like a jokey one about Satanism. There's another one about abolishing ICE. Mm-hmm. But because of that, that puts that these people who, again, There's no allegation that they touched any gun, let alone shot a cop, in the same category as the guy who allegedly did that. And so they're all facing these material support for terrorism
they're
charges.
All facing these charges. Some of them, as you say, just for publishing. Sounds like there's a First Amendment issue there, as far as I could tell, just for publishing opinions in a magazine. Now, as I understand from your reporting, the Trump administration, during their first term, they did not interpret 2339A this way. What changed? Apparently, this is tied to the killing of Charlie Kirk.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think with a lot of the Trump administration moves, it's hard to even say what's tied to what. But it's true that after the killing of Charlie Kirk, the Trump administration took that as an opportunity to blame his death on the left. And they took it as an opportunity to justify what is now becoming a campaign of repression. And so they started laying legal kind of architecture for that in late September and early October. And that took the form of memos that the White House issued. The biggest one is called NSPM 7. Mm-hmm. And what it does is it directs prosecutors in going after domestic terrorism cases to prioritize matters that involve beliefs in anti-Americanism, anti-Christianity, anti-capitalism. Also, there are other phrases they use in there. You know, extremism on gender ideology, extremism on race and migration. It's all very vague, but what it basically tells prosecutors is, look, we know who the culprits are. It's people who have these beliefs that are kind of vaguely associated with left-wing ideologies or left-wing causes or left-wing speech. And we want you to go and build domestic terrorism cases around them. So what it does is it flips the normal order of how an investigation is supposed to work, at least in law enforcement matters. What you want is you want there to be evidence, and they then follow the evidence to a culprit, right? We want there to be evidence that something is going to happen, and they intercept the plot before it takes place. Here, what they have is they have culprits that are associated with a given ideology, and they're demanding investigations into that ideology in order to find a crime.
Yeah, they're setting up, let's find out if we consider them to be anti-American, anti-Christian, anti-capitalism, which all sounds like an ideology. I mean, you can't go after people for those things, but I guess they're figuring out how to do that now. And, you know, in the bargain, I mean, it seems like we're seeing people that have nothing to do with actual, not just actual terrorism, but in many cases, even the actual crime that is being charged that they are then turning into this broader, enterprise case, as you describe it, with, you know, looking at their associates and seeing how they can be somehow tied to what they're calling a terrorist group. Josh Kavinsky, isn't this exactly what many civil libertarians feared, warned about following 9/11? And the spate of laws expanding domestic law enforcement that we saw with the Patriot Act and other legislation, and that incident I mentioned where I, you know, found myself to be targeted secretly in these documents that were, you know, created with software tools made for the war on terror. Isn't this exactly what many folks warned about going on more than two decades ago at this point?
It is. And if you look at the commentary in the early 2000s after 9/11 around what a slippery slope this was, specifically around the Patriot Act, I mean, it's all very eerie. And I don't want to get too far into the legal weeds on this. There's one really specific change the Patriot Act made, which is that it allowed prosecutors to say that people who provided intangible support to alleged material to an act of terrorism could be prosecuted for that. And that's a lot of what's happening here, because the government now has the power to stretch that. What does that mean, intangible support? It could be advice, it could be a lot of things, it could be expertise, but they're allowed to stretch that in a way that allows them to do what they're doing in Texas, which is draw in a much broader range of people. One thing that I think is also important to note, though, is that, these concerns are bearing fruit, but at the same time, it's not like we're seeing, you know, Karl Rove or like Ken Edelman get charged with material support for terrorism, right? And the people who were responsible for these changes back then, are not the ones who are bearing the brunt of it. I mean, people who are bearing the brunt of it are, right? I mean, they're activists who are going out to oppose the administration in various ways.
Yep.
The victims haven't necessarily changed over time.
Is this interpretation of 2339A and this, just this entire notion, this tangible support for terrorism as applied in these cases, these domestic cases, things that are clearly not you know, the type of terrorism that the Patriot Act was meant to defend against. Is it holding up in court? Where it's not enough to simply charge, oh, that person is Antifa. He was wearing black, to announce BLM as a terror organization. Presumably, you have to come up with actual evidence. Are we finding that these cases, these charges, are actually holding up, and the government is able to prove these claims once they make it to trial?
So the Birmingham case is in very early stages, so we just don't know what the judge thinks yet. In Texas, they got a very pro-Trump judge, and it seems like that case is going forward. I mean, they're scheduled for trial in a week or two, so we'll see what happens there.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I would note is that it's not a coincidence that both of these prosecutions were filed in deep red states, both in extremely conservative, federal appellate circuits.
Yeah.
It's going to be even, I mean, I was talking to one of the Texas attorneys here, and he was saying that even if his client gets convicted, and let's say the judge decides to sentence far below the guidelines, he thinks that he would probably lose on an appeal to the circuit court.
Because he'll say that, say it again. I missed you there. He'll do what on appeal?
That he would probably lose on the appeal. If the government then appealed the sentence, he would probably lose, and the circuit court would impose a higher sentence if he ends up getting a lighter one from the judge. So the attorneys in these cases know the environment they're operating in. So there's that. The other point I would just make that I think people should be aware of is that, you know, with this material support law, they don't necessarily have to say that you were supporting, let's say, Hamas or Al-Qaeda or Antifa, whatever that is, right? With this one, Congress has made a list of crimes that count as terrorism, that are listed as crimes of terrorism. And as long as they show that you knowingly intended to support one of those crimes being committed, then they can, in theory, prosecute you on this charge. Mm-hmm. So the weakness is going to come partly around, like, you know, these questions of ideology, whether or not they're targeting people for their beliefs. But a lot of it is really going to come down to, you know, I think intent. Like, if you show up to a protest with an Antifa scene wearing black, and somebody, you know, 100 yards away from you shoots a gun and hits a cop, you know, are you on the hook for that or not under the statute? I think that's where, like, a lot of where the weaknesses are going to come in these cases.
Yeah, and apparently you are now, simply for supporting it by being there and choosing the wrong color clothing to wear, I guess, in the case of a claim that this was a crime by Antifa. It's kind of amazing. And of course, you know, I note that in some of the stories you mentioned here, some of the folks are pleading guilty just because it's easier to plead guilty to a charge like this, that they can't afford to go to trial, as crazy as the charges may be. It's easier to get off easy with a guilty plea. And again, in some of these, you know, very red areas. Amazing. I will point folks toward your report on this. Headline: Trump DOJ files 9/11 era charges against leftists across the country. And if it all creeps you out, then you can flip on over to his other story this week: 2020's most insane conspiracy theory, Italygate returns. And you'll feel all better in the bargain. Josh Kavinsky, investigative reporter for TalkingPointsMemo.com, where you can always find his work. You can also find him on the Blue Skies at Josh Kavinsky. Josh, good work. Thank you for everything you're doing. And really great speaking with you again today, sir.
All right. Thanks, Brad. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Josh. Okay, well, there's a couple of crazy stories for you.
Yeah. Now, a couple of things jump out at me from this.
Okay.
For one thing, the DOJ change in their approach to this domestic terrorism, to making it a domestic terrorism violation, it does leave open the risk of right-wing provocateurs who pose as protesters. Mm. Remember Umbrella Man during the George Floyd protests in Minneapolis?
Also up in Minneapolis. Yeah.
Yes, and that
it was a right wing provocateur showed up and, like, smashed some windows at the auto parts store,
trying to make the protesters look bad, even though they were being peaceful. So that's a thing that people will need to stay aware of as they are observing and bearing witness to ICE and CPB mm-hmm. operations yeah. around wherever they are, but particularly in Minneapolis. And also, it seems pretty obvious to me that the Trump administration is working really, really hard to intimidate people, to chill free speech and the right to free assembly oh, yeah. and all of that. Wired Magazine at Wired.com has put together an extensive new series with advice and tips for people on how they can protect themselves and those around them as they participate in peaceful protest and witness and legal observers and all of that
sure.
in order to protect themselves.
Because that's what all of this is about, of
yes.
course. You know, they want you to be afraid that if something happens, oh, you're going to be tied in. You're going to be one of the terrorists. That's why they came out immediately after the killing of Renee Good, after Alex Pretty, that, oh, these are domestic terrorists. They couldn't wait to try to pretend that that was the case, that this was part of a domestic terrorist ring. They still talk about we're getting really close to finding out who is funding all
right.
of this.
Which
all
is a
of
bunch
these
of nonsense,
people coming
but...
out and following ICE around in the streets. Nobody is funding them.
They just can't stand the idea that neighbors want to protect their neighbors and communities actually are cohesive and hold together and care about each other.
And America hates their crap policies
yeah.
and are willing to show up and fight against them, protect people against them. But no, it's all terrorists and we're going to use the terror. And this was, you know, like I said, what many of us have been worrying about. Going back 15, 20 years when they passed yep. all of these laws and, it's the war on terror. We had to put all of these things in place. Never mind us, you know, civil libertarians and our concerns. Those things will never come back to haunt us. Well, what do you know? Anyway, got to get out.
Yes.
Thank you very much once again to TPM's Josh Kavinsky, to our producer, Desi Doyen, to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show, or any other since the beginning of time, download it for free at bradblog.com. No paywall, thanks to those of you who hit a donate button when you stop on by. It's really appreciated and needed right now. You can go straight to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves as long as we can. Drop me an email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the social medias, especially Blue Sky, you'll find me at The Brad Blog. Dressed in black. We'll see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world. You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported thanks to listeners like you who stop by bradblog.com/donate.